Rich B. from Ocean City, Maryland.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rich Brucker. I'm an alcoholic. And I thank Shannon and Dave. I don't know about you all, but I've been blown away this morning, and I'm a better guy for having been here today and hearing your experience with this wonderful thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and God, and I'm not sure which is which or that they're different, but it sure has been neat hearing. The fact that I can remember my first drink that I'm going to tell you about is kind of a hint. Is there anybody in their first year of sobriety with us today? Right on. Welcome, and I'll probably drop some hints for anybody deciding whether or not AA is for you or not. The first is that if my job today was to tell you about my first Coca-Cola, you'd need to get somebody else. I don't remember that. If it was to tell you about my first glass of milk, you'd need to get somebody else. I don't remember that. But I do know about my first experience with alcohol, which right away tells you that there's something different about my relationship with alcohol than any other beverage in my life. What it was, I went to a little school outside of Baltimore, a town called Hunt Valley. It actually looks a lot like this, beautiful rolling hills, horse country. Up to third grade, I went to a public school. My parents took me out of that public school to send me to a private school where I had a 45-minute long bus ride every day. It's also where I found out that we were poor. I didn't know that until they sent me there, but third graders are really good like that. They just tell you how it is. They don't hold anything back. I had chores in the morning and cleaning out horse stalls, and they would call me redneck, farm boy, you know, names like that. I don't know that it's a prerequisite to be an alcoholic, to hate your parents, but it seems a good start for a lot of us. And I've heard a lot of fifth steps, and there's always something on there, it seems like. And my parents' big crime through our inventory process, when I look back, I came from a household a lot like what we've heard about. You know, the only dysfunctional part of my family was me. Nobody in my whole family drinks, no aunts, uncles, grandparents, mother and father. I have one little sister. Nobody drinks. They are wonderful people. They love me to death, not that I could feel it. You know, nobody, and I don't know what that's all about. You know, my love receiver, you know, seems to be clogged along with everything else that alcoholism, does. But, they were just good people. And when I look back through our inventory process, their big crime, I perceived it. And we've heard enough about it. I mean, geez Louise, after Shannon, we don't need any more about alcoholic thinking. I mean, that was just listening was exhausting. It was like, woo. And the story of my life. So if you find yourself going like this to any of the three people that you've heard today, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it might be a duck. But what I thought they did was I thought that they ripped me away from my friends to send me to this horrible school, and like they somehow did that to me intentionally. And what I now know is that they were hardworking, middle to low income people that saved every penny and practically went broke to give me a better opportunity at life than they ever had, and I hated them for it. And I was going to hold that for about the next 20 years of my life. And on that school bus, they assigned me a kid named Reed. Reed's job was to beat me up every day for something. I hated that. But fortunately, on the bus, there was a couple of chicky poos, but one in particular that looked like a lot of you women that are here today. Her name was Nikki, and Nikki was spectacular. And I didn't know how to talk to Nikki. I didn't know how to ask Nikki out. I didn't know how to ask her to dance. I mean, I got nothing. But on this day, and I think I was in roughly 6th, 7th grade, and I had a fascination with hanging out with the older kids. I don't know what that's always about. I just want to be with them, and they punch me, and I go away, and I get to feel rejected, but I try again tomorrow. And some of the older kids said, "You want to skip last class and do some drinking?" And I'd never skipped any class, and I'd never done any drinking, and I said, "You bet," like I'd been doing it all along. And they said, "What do you drink?" And I said, "Bourbon." And, I mean, I've never had anything. And I don't know where that came from. And I wish I got to tell you that we had bourbon, because this is kind of bourbon country down here, and it's kind of manly, you know. And this is how you know I wasn't shooting for AA at 7th grade, you know. And I sure as heck didn't know I was going to have to report back, which, by the way, is what I think this particular job is in AA is reporting back. I'm not one of these people that'll go, you know, like, I gotta stand it. It's just terrible that I got, you know. I like doing this. I think it's fun. I think it's exciting. And I think it's the greatest gift in the world, which is to give you back that which you gave to me. It's to report back on God's handiwork. We call it our stories, our AA life. And what it really is telling you what you all have done for me by and through your 12 steps. And if you're not excited about getting to do that, I'm not sure which is going to get you excited. Good luck. When people at the meeting say, you know, I'm sober today by the grace of God, I'm like, wow, that's not exciting to you? Like, it doesn't get better than that. And, and I'm also not one of the ones that you're going to find pouting around meetings, going, I'm powerless over people, places, and things. You know, that's not what my book says. That is not what my book says. My book says that I have been given the power. It's not mine. I got to be real clear on that. To help where nobody else can. And that I've been uniquely harnessed to get rid of all of that old stuff so that this power can flow through me, much like a conduit, to you just the same way you gave it to me. And that we get to do that for each other where nobody else on earth can do that. And quite literally, we're given the power to save lives. And if that's not exciting, I don't know what is. And I'm not going to mope around about it. And what happened on this day with these older guys skipping that class? They started passing around. I wish it was bourbon. This is how you know I wasn't coming here. It was peach schnapps, right? And I knew you were going to laugh at me because it happens every time because it's so weeny. But what makes me one of you is not what alcohol does to me. Alcohol does to people the same thing. It's what it does for me that makes me one of you. That's why I get to hang with you. We're the people that alcohol does something special for me, not to me. And I'm willing to let it do so much to me in exchange for what it does for me. That's what normal people are not willing to let it do, right? They get that first DUI. They go into the hospital, have their liver biopsy. You know, like something happens. Our book calls it a substantial event. A woman says, I love you very much, but I can't stay with you because of your drinking. And we go, well, then by all means, I'll stop drinking. You know, not me. I go, there's the door. You know, if it's between you and drinking, that's not a decision. You're not leaving me many options here. And we just have this very special relationship with alcohol because of what it does for me. And on that day, I got on the school bus. I decide I'm going to sit next to Nikki after drinking this peach schnapps with the fellas. And I just somehow intuitively knew how to handle this Nikki thing that used to baffle me. And I'm going down there, and Reed gets up out of his seat on the bus to give me my daily beating. And as he's getting to his feet, I clock him with everything my little body has. Reed went down, and he went out. I mean, he was done. Out. And I sat down next to Nikki, and I'm looking at Nikki, and Nikki's looking at me, and I'm looking at Nikki, and the whole bus is really, really quiet. I mean, there's like this feeling I've been waiting for my whole life, like long overdue respect. Some of you guys remember this. You know, finally you know who I am. And when we got to Nikki's bus stop, she leaned over and she gave me this little kiss that some of you guys might fess up to, but every one of you remembers it. Half on the lips, half on the cheek. And it's different than the way that my mother or my aunt had ever kissed me. I mean, I felt it in my toes. You know? And I went in there. She got off. I go into my house, into that nice house. Morals, integrity, all kinds of great stuff is taught to me in that household. And I'm obviously drunk. And my parents leave me in the bathroom getting sick. Peach schnapps is way better going one way than the other. It's very syrupy. Don't need to create much of an after lunch visual. And but they leave me in there, you know, for the whole night to be sick and to teach me a lesson. That's another thing about an alcoholic of my variety. A whole lot of people along the road of life are going to try to teach me a lesson that may have captured the attention of the average drinker, the hard drinker, the heavy drinker. Certainly not me. That stuff goes right past. Maybe should have gotten my attention, but didn't. I wake up the next morning. My neck is really, really stiff, kinked up next to the toilet. You know how we sleep. And every one of us has woken up in that special position that you didn't even know the neck could twist, right? And I'm so hungover, and I was grounded forever. That's a big deal in like sixth or seventh grade. That's like life without parole when we get older. And the next thought was like, holy cow, you're sick as a dog. I don't ever remember being this sick, and I've never been in this much trouble. Are you ever going to do any more of that drinking? You bet. Are you kidding me? Sick as a dog, grounded forever. What a small price to pay for what I had going on that school bus, man. Nikki, that kiss, that respect. I mean, what I didn't know was that something inside of me shifted. Just like Bill talks about in his story. With my relationship with alcohol, it was going to give me so much for so long. Just like a boomerang set in flight. And while that baby was going out, it was magnificent. And little did I know it was going to turn in flight one day and come back and nearly shred me to ribbons. And it was going to take from me every bit of morality, every bit of integrity, every value system that those parents instilled in me, one drink at a time. And it was going to take them so slowly that I didn't even know it was happening. I had no idea I was surrendering those things. I used to say alcohol took them. I think I gave them over. One drink at a time, so slow that I never knew it was happening. And our book talks about that too. It says that by the time the alcoholic realizes what's happening, that it's often too late. We've slipped past this point of human aid, but I'm the last one to figure it out. And in high school in Hunt Valley and around Baltimore, what high school drinking looks like for me is almost every weekend. It's hard to do during the week. We build bonfires and fields and drive, somebody gets a keg of beer and that kind of drink. And I'm driving a CJ7 Jeep with no doors and no roof, because that's what you drive when you're like a really cool lacrosse player. And at least so you think. And I got a keg of beer in the back and three or four friends, and I go around a turn too fast, and that Jeep rolls about three times, and all of my friends go out into the field. Everybody's banged up and busted up, some broken bones, some cuts, but nobody's seriously injured. And you know what I think? Do you see that? That was some good drunk driving right there. I mean, that was like NASCAR stuff. I mean, that thing rolled, and boom, I landed on my feet. I mean, did you see that? And, you know, right past me, it never occurs to me, you almost killed your best friends. Don't even, that never comes to mind. I honestly thought like that was good drunk driving. If you're one of those folks that raised your hand, I will tell you that I'm embarrassed to say I've sat around many a bar room and I've said the sentence more times than I care to admit, I'm a good drunk driver. Somebody said that in this room. And, you know, and then I would follow that up with an even dumber sentence. I drive better drunk than sober. I'll tell you what. You know, I put the windows 3/4 of the way down. You get a cigarette going for the smell. You got to have a mint ready. You get the volume just right, but you get the wind's got to be coming through. I squint one eye. You focus that eye on the left of the two line. You know, and I go through this elaborate system of how I get home, right? If you have a system for drunk driving, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know that normal people have drunk driving systems, but we do. And I tell that story, and after the meeting, somebody always will come up and tell me their system. You know, what I did is I took a stick and lodged it against the wheel. I mean, they're brilliant stuff we come up with. I get arrested a lot in high school for underage drinking, drunk in public, my personal favorite, failure to obey the lawful command of an officer. Just not big on listening. You'll get the flavor of this. I don't care. There's three types of people I don't do well with. Police, prosecutors, and judges. They just see things. They're very severe, and they just, I don't like the way they see things. And, I mean, we're just trying to figure things out. You know, Dave and I are sorting out a bar bill in front of the bar because he was supposed to buy the last round and he didn't. And you know what they call that? They call that second degree assault. I mean, it's such a serious name, and all we're doing was sorting the bill out. But that's how cops are, and prosecutors buy that kind of stuff. And so my parents are leaving me in jail for the weekend. It got to that point, which I now know is very hard for my mother, to leave me in jail for the whole weekend when something would happen on Friday. But she did that to teach me a lesson. You know what that is for me? That's just a better story on Monday. You know, I don't learn anything. My behavior doesn't change. Just a better story on Monday. I eventually get a scholarship to go to college. God's given me a couple, well, God's given each of us a unique set of gifts, talents, whatever word you like to put on it. It's those things that we may or may not even know about, but they sure keep us drunk when we're not using them. Anyways, two of them for me. I was very good athletically, and I have an incredible memory. This is very different from being smart. I want to clear this up. What that means is I read something and I can tell you what page it's on, which paragraph, and remember it the rest of my life. And if I have a physics test tomorrow, I could read the book today and remember it all tomorrow and spit it back out. That does very well for testing. It is absolutely useless. Out there living life, I'm not learning any skills like studying, the ethics, the discipline, the commitment of going to class. I don't have to do any of that. So I'm learning nothing important, and I'm confused by this. I'm seemingly excelling at the game of life, right? Growing up, my dad taught me to surf before I could even remember. It's my favorite thing in the world. To this day, I surf almost every day. And so my college requirements, I went to the University of San Diego. It's the school that I picked to play soccer for. Two requirements was that they had good waves, and the second was that they were as far as possible from those really nice parents and their rules and morals and values. So off I went. I overlooked one thing, and that's that it happened to be a Jesuit college. I didn't know what Jesuits are. I could care less. I'm on scholarship, which is how you go to college when you don't have any money. I fit in with some other guys that are there on soccer scholarship. There's four of them because they don't have any money. And, of course, this is perception. I now know through our inventory process that there's lots of ways that I could have looked at it that I didn't. Like, oh, no, you got to go there because you did very well academically and you brought something to the school on the soccer field. That's why they wanted you. I don't see it that way. They gave me a scholarship because we're broke, pathetic, and poor, and I came from a farm, and that's what the kids in third grade told me, and I'm hanging on to it, baby. I'm now like 18, right, and I'm hanging on to it, that old idea. But that's how I see it. There's a spiritual principle called water seeks its own level. That means I surround myself with that which I am. It's why our geographics never work. Wherever I go, there I am. You can drop me in the middle of a desert, and I will find people that drink like me and do the other stuff I do within a day of being there. And I'll go, what happened to my fresh start? Right? I came all this way for a fresh start. But wherever I go, there I am, and water always seeks its own level. I'll digress. My inventory, that's why most of the guys, and I've heard an awful lot of inventory, I don't know how many fifth steps I've heard, probably over 100 at this point. And there's always a series of women for most guys, right? And they're going down that, and in it there, it's they usually end, and I'm like, wow, there's been like 9 of those. You know, just change the name, you know, insert name here, same behavior. And then they usually follow it up with a sentence like, yeah, if there's a crazy broad out there, I'll find her. And I go, yes, you will, because water seeks its own level. How could you attract anything but that? And the female inventory, usually after that series of guys' names, ends with a sentence like, if that guy's a jerk, I'll attract him. I attract nothing but jerks. Water seeks its own level. So anyways, that's a bad line to lay on your sponsor when you get to the fifth step. Don't say, you know, I really attract a crazy broad, because they'll just look at you and go, yeah, you do. What else could you attract? But I didn't know that back then. And I'm at this college, and to fit in, we've already heard we're good sizer uppers. You know, I could fit in anywhere. If I'm in horse country, all of a sudden I'm some kind of equestrian. If I'm at the Grateful Dead show, I'm a hippie. If I'm on the soccer field, I'm, you know, a jock guy. And at this school, you were going to need some stuff. It was the guys with the nice cars and the dough in their pocket that were getting the hot chicks. And I didn't have any stuff. And I sort of embarked on a different path. To abbreviate the story, I'll just tell you where I get to. By my senior year, I'm in the cocaine business. I'm also, I purchased my first house in La Jolla, 423 Nautilus Street. It's the third house up from Wind and Sea Beach on the right-hand side. La Jolla is one of the most beautiful places in this country. If you've never had a chance to go there, get there. And spectacular, but I don't surf anymore because I drink. And when I drink, that's all I do. I have to give up every single joy, everything that brings me any intrinsic value, that genuine feeling of hope that this is going to be a good day. Life is exciting. Life is fun. Can't wait to see what happens next. Anything in my life that generates those feelings, drinking takes away. I don't do any of my hobbies, any of my passions. I just drink. I'm driving a silver BMW convertible. It's got a number on the back for you Beamer people. Lets you know that they don't even make or sell this model in the country. It's one of the European ones. Had to have it shipped over on a boat because I'm that important. I'm dating the prettiest girl in the school, or at least that's what you all thought. So I dated her. I still have no idea if I ever liked her. But that's how I roll by that point in life, is, you know, to impress people that I don't know or like. And it's about 5 o'clock in the morning, one morning, and boom, 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 every single door and window in that house came in, and I'm on my stomach, and the next thing I know, they're putting those plastic zip ties, and they're hog tying me and taking me off to the federal penitentiary. It's called MCC, the Metropolitan Correction Center in downtown San Diego. And in case you missed out on this, I'm not a prison guy. I'm not a tough guy. I have been arrested, if you pulled it to this day, there's knock on wood, it stopped at 36. There were 36 arrests on that NCIC. And it would really, it should just say drunk and stupid at the top. They're all things like I told you. There's no impressive tough guy gangster stuff. It's all, you know, drunk in public. You know, idiot, idiot, idiot is what it should just say. But it turns out that those things add up. The San Diego Union Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, their headline said, Jesuit student, 27 kilos of cocaine. And in the federal system, there's a thing called the federal sentencing guidelines. Statistically, somebody here has done some federal time, probably. All right, got my guy. And the way that it works, judges' hands are tied. They look and they go, the number of arrests and all those 36 little things I did, it turns out they count. Right, and they go down to 36, and then they look at the amount of dough, and they go like this. And my chart said 46 to 60 years they're supposed to sentence me to, and I don't do 46 to 60 years. I'm a jail guy. I specialize in like 6 month sentences, 9 months here and there. I'll do a year, standing on my head, 30 days at a time, no problem. No problem. I specialize in jail. I'm doing life on the installment program, 30 days at a time, and I don't see it that way, but that's what's happening. But prison, you know, no thank you. 46, that's too much. And I sponsor two guys that love prison. They thrive in prison. They do much better in prison than in the outside world. They're wonderful members of AA. They've started meetings. They sponsor people. Every time they get out, they commit a crime within a week to go back in. They love that level of structure and discipline and routine and the certainty of knowing where their meals are coming from. And they know when the AA meeting is. And they just love it in there. I am not one of those guys. I like being with you all. And so this was scary to me, is the point of that. And while I'm in that penitentiary, it's worth noting that I was the only person in there that was guilty. It holds about 1,600 men. 1,599 of them were innocent. And I know that because it's all they talk about all day, you know, in the yard, is why they're innocent, why this is one big misunderstanding. Chances are there's somebody here today that's here by accident, you know. That's another thing. If you had your hand up and you think you're here by accident and a series of bad breaks, you know, maybe a misunderstanding, welcome to AA. A lot of us got here that way. And what started as a misunderstanding may turn out to be the greatest miracle of your life. I didn't say it in the beginning. I usually do. My sobriety date is August the 30th of 04. I was separated from alcohol on that day. I didn't quit drinking. I didn't put the plug in the jug. My best thinking didn't bring me to you. I hate when I hear that stuff said in a meeting, because if any of that's true, it makes me non-alcoholic by definition. You know what that implies? If I quit drinking, you know what? I made a decision to come to AA. I put the plug in the jug. Did I have power, choice, or control? Non-alcoholic. On August the 29th of that year, I was drunk as a monkey and, like Dave, had no thought or intention of ever being sober. And on August the 30th, due to some series of events that I had little to nothing to do with, I was sober all day and didn't have to put a drink or anything else in my body. And there's not a step for that. There's no explanation. We don't have a chapter on stopping drinking. That's the greatest gift I've ever received in my life. And you know what AA helps me do? AA helps me to accept the gift, to respect it, and to protect it. And that's what we do by and through the 12 steps. That's our method of accepting a gift, respecting it, and protecting it, and being together and walking this walk that we get to walk together. But in there, they're all, you know, I now know what this power, and I'm going to call it a power God because it's got three letters and it's quick. God surrounded me with enough of me that I could see me for the first time. And when I say that word God, whatever popped in your head, that's what I'm talking about. I hope the English language doesn't separate us. It's the best thing we have to communicate. If I knew something else, I'd use it, because it comes up so lacking, especially talking about a power of that magnitude. It's just, and when, no matter which word we choose, half the room's going, I don't call it that, I call it this. And the other going, oh, I don't call it that, I call it this. You know, whatever you think, that's what I'm talking about. So I hope that that word, when I say it, brings us together. And what I now know is that wonderful power surrounded me with enough of me that I could see me for the very first time. And I heard stories like this that I'd been telling my whole life. The problem with these stories is that I'm delusional. I'm not in denial. Dave talked about it beautifully, which means I believe my own lie. Denial, I take your purse. And you say, did you take my purse? And I go, no, I didn't. And I'm hooked up to a lie detector. I know darn well I took your purse. I'm just denying it. And the lie detector goes, boop, 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 boop. I mean, I'm just lying. And I darn well know, did you take my? No. But delusion, I take her purse. She says, did you take my purse? I said, no, I didn't. Let me help you look for it. I'm hooked up to that lie detector. And that's a form of mental illness, by the way, but I'm greatly offended when we get to the second step and you infer that my thinking might be off. But that's what I'm suffering from. And these guys at this penitentiary, listen to these stories. This guy says, you know, the reason I'm in here is because my mechanic. And if my mechanic had fixed my taillight right, that cop would have never pulled me over. And if the cop hadn't pulled me over, he'd have never smelled the alcohol in my breath, pulled me out of the car. After he arrested me, he searched the trunk incident to arrest, and that's where he found all the dope. And if I ever get out of here and find that mechanic, we're going to get this thing straightened out. And that guy absolutely believes that he has nothing to do with happening, that it's all his mechanic's fault. And it just clued. I'm like, man, I've been telling stories like that my whole life. My whole life. I mean, I said things as stupid as, like, if the bartender hadn't closed the bar at 2:00, I wouldn't have been driving. Right? I mean, clearly it's his fault for closing the bar. You know, and I believe things like this. And anyways, the next thing that I noticed in there is that I was where I was because of who I was. And I was who I was because of how I live. And I'll repeat that because that is a big, big deal in my life. That is the beginning of a tremendous awakening. An awakening is simply an attitude and outlook adjustment. The way I think, feel, and experience the world as a whole, the way that I see things are starting to change. And realizing that I was where I was because of who I was, and I'm who I am because of how I act. Huge. In other words, my tombstone's not going to say, here lies Rich Bruckner, he meant well. I always meant well. I'm the sum total of my actions, and that's it. Nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous, AA's got the same principle, by the way. Nobody in this room cares what I think about the big book. You know, Ross has never pulled me aside and said, hey, buddy, you think this thing's well written? You know, do you like the numbering of the steps? Do you have any suggestions for us? You know, are the words a little antiquated for you? Perhaps you'd like to modernize it. Nobody ever asked me that. You all care very much about what I do, not what I think. We've got a chapter in here in understanding. Understanding AA doesn't help. You know, there's two types of people in AA. Those that have been through our steps and had a spiritual awakening, and those that haven't yet. That's it. Those are the only two kinds of alcoholics in AA. Those that have been through the work and had this thing called awakening, and those that haven't yet. And nobody's better than anybody else, by the way. In fact, if you have been through, had that thing called awakening, all you have is more increased responsibility to put back into AA to help the next little guy or girl, that next little suffering bugger, to come on with me. Come on, come on. Try this. Right? That's what all of our meetings, what we are at AA, by the way, in case anybody's gotten off the page, we're a spiritual program of action with a support fellowship, not the other way around. Not the other way around. You know, come on, come with us. All of this stuff, these weekends, these conferences, our dances, all of the wonderful fellowship stuff, our sponsors, all of that are mechanisms put in place to push us into the steps, to turn back to God through our steps and encourage us through. And where are you? When's the last time you've written inventory? Are you staying sober today on yesterday's inventory? What have you done today? What's your current experience with our 12 steps? I don't care what you did 10 years ago. What's your current experience, right? And that's why I come here, is for you all to say things like that to me, to keep me moving, to keep me excited about Alcoholics Anonymous, to keep me current. I'm not full today on yesterday's lunch. I ate today's, and it was good, thank you. It was good. I was in there for 9 months and 1 week. It turns out that the week before trial, the DEA had some problems of their own on the affidavit to get the search warrant to come into my house. It was determined to be an illegal search. All the cocaine was suppressed. It was not allowed to be used at trial, and the case was dismissed. I would love to tell you that I walked out a free man, but anybody that's been in the penitentiary knows the day you get out, you are thirsty. And by that point, alcohol owned me lock, stock, and barrel. It told me when I was waking up, when I was going to sleep, how long I was going to sleep, which end of my body I was going to address the toilet with. There was no, you know, there was no illusion about who was running who. And, you know, and I'd have told you that at that point. And I just thought that this is, you know, I was consigned to go out the way alcoholics go out. I guess I'm just going to drink until it ends. I couldn't go home because I'd shame my mother and father and everybody in my family. I'd bled them dry. The other thing about an alcoholic of my variety that turns out isn't any different than the other two alcoholics we've heard today is the more you love me, the more I will suck you dry. I will take every penny out of your pocket. I will take your measly little retirement and not even think about it. I'll turn every hair on your head gray and not lose a wink of sleep. And the more you love me, the more I will take, take, take. Because if you don't love me like that, you won't let me do it. You're long since done with me. But those that love me the most stuck around the longest for the most severe beating. God bless them. And I walk around waving that alcoholic flag when I get here, saying the biggest lie any of us tell, I'm only hurting myself. Right? I start bouncing around. I'm going to plan Sun Valley. I can't stay where I am. There's a whole lot of people looking for me. By this point in my life, I got some dear friends in this room that I get to surf with and spend time with. I've been stabbed in Panama. I have an M branded on my shoulder from the guys in Mexico that I work for so that I'd never forget who owned me and who I worked for. I can't stay where I am, and I can't go home. I'm like a man without a country, and I'm drinking to forget about the life I ruined before it ever started. I had a chance to be one of the first people in my family, the second generation. My mother and father got to go to college, and they were so proud to pass that on, and I could have been the second gen, you know. Missed it by this much. Remember, get smart, missed it by that much. And almost, you know, I could have. There's that old movie, I could have been a contender. You know, and when Bill Wilson, by the way, he did his fifth step with Father Ed Dowling. And when Bill did his fifth step after he's all finished, Ed Dowling looked at him and said something. It's in a book, Not God, by Ernest Kurtz, if anybody likes reading about the history of AA. It's the best history book ever written. And Father Ed Dowling turns to Bill after Bill does all of this confession type stuff, you know, about what he's done, what he's done, what he's done, what he's done. And Ed Dowling looks at him and says, you know, Bill, it's usually not the things men and women have done in their past that keep them drunk and getting drunk again and again. You know what it is, Bill? It's the things they've left undone. And that was certainly my case. I was that close to college. I was that close to a lot of things in my life. Langston Hughes wrote a poem called The Boogie Woogie Rumble of a Dream Deferred. And somewhere deep in my stomach, there were some dreams, man. And I was just going to, they just haunted me, you know, because I could have. I was just so close. And I'm bouncing around trying to forget this stuff, and I can't. It just won't go away, and I can't go home, and I can't stay where I am. And I'm going from Sun Valley, Ketchum, Idaho, to Steamboat, Colorado, to Boulder, Colorado. When I drink, I get warrants, because that's what happens when I drink. Nobody's ever told me the next day it was really nice what you were doing last night. You were up there at the, you know, grocery store helping the old ladies unload groceries. I don't do that kind of stuff when I'm drunk. I get in trouble. When I get in trouble, I run away because I'm a coward. You know, tough guys face the fire. They walk through the fire. They face the music. When I hear there's a warrant, I leave town. Meanwhile, if I run into any of you women at the bar, you know, let's say we're at the Million Dollar Cowboy Bar in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I take out a pocket full of money that is no doubt not mine or earned illegally. I buy you a drink and you say, so what's your story, cowboy? And I say, traveling, babe, just traveling. Like I'm some type of romantic sojourner across our great land. You know, I'm like one step ahead of the law, but I'm delusional, you know. And eventually it comes to an end, and much like Dave and probably half the room, I end up where all big shot, tough guy, wannabe, you know, drug dealers wind up when the federal government takes your house, your bank account, all your cars and everything else. I end up back on my mom's couch in Ocean City, Maryland. And a lot of you are smiling and nodding, which means we got mom's couch people. And it's a great place to start your sobriety. There's only one rule there. You can stay here as long as you want, as long as... Oh yeah, we got it. As long as you don't drink. And that's the deal. And I was never, ever, ever going to drink again. And I mean, and I meant business. And if you'd have hooked me up to that lie detector machine, I'd have passed it. I was never going to drink. And I thought it was my decision. I thought I got to make decisions like that. I had no idea that that's what being an alcoholic is. I've lost power, choice, and control, but I don't know that yet. And I made it 2.5 weeks at mom's house without drinking on my best, most sincere effort to not drink. And I'm coming in and out of your meetings, you know, and I've been, you know, I don't care for them much, but I come in and out. There's certain kinds I really don't like. Any meeting, I mean, whoever this is, you shouldn't leave it up front. If newcomers see the book, if I saw the book up front, I'd go to a different meeting. I don't like any meeting where they're talking about the book, steps, anything like that. In my area, I don't know what your meeting schedule looks like, so don't take this personally. This is, you know, down in Ocean City, and it's not even like this anymore in Ocean City, thank God. But what our meeting schedule used to look like, they got meetings for guys like me that are not particularly interested in recovering from alcoholism, and they're called discussion meetings. And what happens is they say, you know, and Monday, by the way, our meeting schedule looks like this. You know, Monday night, I won't tell you the meeting name, but it'll just say, I'm reading the type. Open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, step study. Tuesday night, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, big book study. Wednesday, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, nothing else on Wednesday. Thursday, open discussion, open discussion. I go through the whole thing. And what happens at these meetings, in my neck of the woods, they say, does anybody have a topic? And, you know, Franny raises her hand, and Franny starts firing off the topic of the night, which is, you know, that she had a cat, and her cat's name was Mitzi, and she had Mitzi for 14 years. And her and Mitzi were so tight, and she would knit, and little Mitzi would cut with the yarn with her hand, and that's little Mitzi, but Mitzi went outside and got hit by a car, and now the crying starts, and little Mitzi's gone, and I don't know what I'm going to do without Mitzi. I might get another cat, but I'll never find another cat like Mitzi. And she goes on for about 15 or 20 minutes about this cat, and then she calls on her friend Gertie, who no doubt is knitting, and Gertie, it turns out, owned a Yorkshire Terrier. And guess what? She tells us all about her Yorkshire Terrier and her and this dog's relationships, and then she calls on her friend. You know what happens? The meeting ends in an hour. I leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous dying of the fatal progressive disease of alcoholism, knowing no more about recovery from my condition than the second I walked into the meeting. Maybe I'm a better pet owner. My personal favorite topic, you know, anybody got a topic tonight? And I love these, you know, it would be some guy and call on Fred. Well, Fred's topic's always the same. She left me again. You know, and he tells his tale of woe about this relationship. And then he calls on, you know, his buddy Jimmy. And Jimmy, it turns out, he's on his fifth wife, but he's got some sage relationship advice for us. He's going to lays it down for about 15, 20 minutes. And then he calls on Becca. Becca's been married and divorced, married and divorced, married and divorced to the same guy 3 times. And that's not even unusual in AA, but she knows all about relationships. She's going to help us. And she goes on and on and on for about 15, 20 minutes. You know what happens? An hour goes by, and I leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous knowing no more about recovery from the fatal disease of alcoholism than the second I walked into the meeting. Maybe I'm a better dater. There's a woman I hate more than anybody. Her name is Janine. And Janine, she bothers the heck out of me because she's like 18 years sober when I meet her. You know, she's always got the book with her at every meeting. I mean, haven't you read it yet? You're 18 years sober. Why do you got it with you? And she's always carrying it. She's got that stupid smile. A lot of you got it, by the way. I'm sort of outnumbered, you know. And I sit in the back, which is where you're supposed to sit when you're new and pissed and you got to have your collar up like you did in jail and you got to have your arms crossed and a look of disdain and condescension because my life's so good compared to yours. And I'm judging. And then at the end of the meeting, we get to the part of the meeting. Well, let me tell you about Janine. I hesitate right after lunch. If you feel something happen, it's just like a reflux thing because this is terrible. She doesn't call her sponsees. She doesn't call them pigeons like they used to. She calls them duckies. And that, it's enough to make you vomit. I mean, and she'd come into the meeting, right? There'd be like 6 or 8 of them that would follow her into the meeting. And she comes in and Janine sits down and the duckies like file in and they got this stupid look and the smile. And then at the end of the meeting, they say, does anybody have, 30 days, and you get like 10 seconds to say, hey, you got 30 days, and they come up, and the first one's like, my name's Rebecca, Janine's my sponsor, I have 30 days today, I wrote my 4-step, and I'm sharing my 5th step this Saturday, I think I'm getting free, ha ha, and she goes running back, and I'm in the back, and you know what I'm thinking, I swear to God, I'm thinking, I'm going to knock that smile right off her face, I'm going to knock her teeth down her throat, right? And does anybody have 60 days? And the next ducky comes up and is like, hi, my name's Tiffany. I have 60 days. I'm making my amends. Ah! And she goes, and I'm sitting, the same thing. I'm like, I'm going to knock her teeth down her throat. Because then it gets to the worst part of the meeting for a guy like me. And that's the part of the meeting where they go, does anybody have 24 hours or a desire to start over? And I got to do the longest walk in Alcoholics Anonymous one more time to get one more chip. And I eventually make it. I will tell you that, you know, I keep going back out and drinking and keep going back out and drinking. I do get up to 36 days without a drink. Just before that, I'd done a residential burglary on my mom's house because that's, I'm not robbing Bob. He might hurt me. You know, tough guys rob mom. That's who we go after. Good safe target for tough guys. My mom has a restraining order. I'm not supposed to be 1,000 yards of the house or her. With that restraining order, she sleeps with the door dead bolted and her little purse with her little salary of a retired school teacher tucked under her bed. And that should tell you about the previous nature of our relationship. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I break into her house. I'm doing my best commando crawl across the floor of that carpet, across her bedroom. I reach under her bed and I'm going for the purse. And she wakes up and catches me eyeball to eyeball. And she says, Rich, just take it. Would you just take it? And I'm telling you that you can beat me up, you can lock me up, but don't give up on me. That's the opposite of those near misses. That hits me somewhere here. I call it a direct hit. You know, you can't postpone it or neatly evade it, as the book talks about. There's no way around this type of event. It gets me right here. And what happens is I take that purse and stay drunk as long as I can until I come back to you all one more time. And at 36 days without a drink, and I don't dare stay sober because sober is a whole different thing than not drinking. And that's all I was doing, was not drinking, right? That looks a lot different than sober. I'd had my liver biopsy. They took out a fatty spot. When they put that needle through your rib cage and rip out a chunk, that might be another hint that something's wrong at 29. It didn't faze me, so if you're new and that type of thing doesn't capture your attention either, welcome to AA. Hey, we're not the swiftest. And they said, you know, the things that'll shut your liver down faster than anything is Tylenol. No Tylenol for a year, and I got this special diet. And at 36 days, I knew that I couldn't live one more day sober, and I couldn't take so much as one more drink. And I took as many Tylenol as I could get a hold of in that medicine cabinet. What happens next, I don't have a great explanation for, other than this wonderful power. Apparently, my body collapsed on the floor of the kitchen in that crappy apartment, because that's where drunks live, is crappy apartments. Thank God for that. And as my body fell, apparently I hit a refrigerator which thudded into the wall of that crappy apartment, and it was a Tuesday. The lady next door, I've learned, had a perfect attendance record at work. She hadn't missed a day's work in 9.5 years, but she was homesick that day. And she heard that refrigerator hit the wall and it scared the daylights out of her. She ran outside and looked through the front door and saw feet, picked up the phone, dialed 911. I woke up in the same hospital I'd been in 4 times prior, the Atlantic General Hospital in Berlin, for anybody that's been to the beach. And I wake up, I'm in one of those paper sexy hospital gowns that your butt hangs out the back, and they're very good for the ego and self-esteem. Things are beeping and whistling, and I realize, like, I'm such a loser, I couldn't even die right, right? Somebody in here knows that feeling. It's just below loser. On the continuum of loserdom, you know, for those of us that you try to, you can't even kill yourself right, that's just below loser. And I'm that guy. And then as my eyes cleared, you know, I'm looking around, and you know who's at the foot of the bed? Janine with the duckies. Yeah, you're laughing, but I'm not sure if there's a place called Alcoholic Hell or not, but I was pretty sure I was in it. And Janine did not talk to me that day. She tried to talk to me plenty. Janine did talk to the duckies. And she said, girls, I want you to take a good look. This is what happens to an alcoholic that refuses to take our steps. Let's go, girls. And that was it. Something inside of me snapped. And I don't know what it is. And I've got to tell you, when I got a sponsor and got into this book, I was hot, man. When I read Bill's story and he got that bright light and that majestic wind that blew through and through, and I got Janine and the duckies. I mean, are you kidding me? Like, did I get shorted or what? But it turns out that it was every bit as significant, because the next thought I've had, I've never had one like it before, and I've never had one since. And you know what that thought was? Changed my life forever. If I live through this, if I get out of here, I'm going to find one of those old guys with that smile on their face and that book in their hand. I'm going to do everything they tell me to do. That's it. That was my big spiritual awakening. That was the voice that came to me find an old guy with a smile on his face and that book in their hand. I'm going to do every, and I don't do anything anybody tells me to do. Hopefully you've got that picture by now. So I don't know where that came from. And I got out of there and I found this guy, Jim. Jim had a sponsor. Jim was in the 40-some years sober. His sponsor was Clarence Snyder, who had a sponsor named Dr. Bob Smith. I tell you that because it's good to know what you got. Because sometimes AA can get a little bit wacky today. We're gonna start up front here with Billy, and Billy's going to pass on the message. He's going to say, the book is blue. Right? Just remember the telephone game in third grade? And he's going to whisper it, and we're going to go around the room, and we're going to get to the back of the room, and I'm going to say, hey, what was the original message that Billy started up here? And the dude in the back of the room is going to say, purple dragons fly at night. I mean, it doesn't even resemble AA. You know, and I'm telling Jim the different things that I hear in meetings. I live at the beach, so I'd come back and I'd always report back. And I'd tell him what I heard at the meeting, and he'd tell me what was in the book, right? And very different. He explained to me that a meeting is not Alcoholics Anonymous, that Alcoholics Anonymous is the name of a book which the fellowship was named after, and sometimes the fellowship follows the program, not so much anymore. That was good to know. He said, just keep running it past me when you hear something, and I'll tell you, and not only would he tell me, he'd show me. Because it's just in black. You know, I got to stay out of that area between the black print. That's where all the crazy happens, is between those black lines. And, you know, I'd hear things like I did my four-step fist. I said, Jim, aren't we supposed to go to the beach? I was at the morning meeting today. We live at the beach. We're supposed to go to the beach when we do this fifth step. We light it on fire and send it out into the ocean. I heard him talking about it. It sounded majestic. It was like a Viking funeral. I mean, aren't we supposed to go do that? And he said, what are you talking about? Where does it say that we light anything on fire? That's your eighth step list. You're going to need it to make amends. What did you hear? Where were you? Would you please stop going to BB? And I said, what is BB, Jim? And he said, I don't know, but it is not AA. And he took our meeting schedule and started to circle the meetings that might maybe be a good idea if I went to them. You know, my whole life started changing before my eyes, and I learned what was wrong with me by this guy, Silky. That's what I call Silkworth. He's like my best friend. Because I've got this body that can't handle alcohol coupled with a mind that won't leave it alone. That's a hell of a predicament. What that means is when I take the first drink, it asks for a second. Second drink begs for a third. Third drink demands the fourth, and the fourth drink insists on the fifth, and I want the sixth drink more than I ever wanted the first. Our book says that never happens for the average or temperate drinker. So if that makes any sense to you, by the way, those are all the fights and negotiations we have with bartenders at 2:05 a.m. Can I get just one more? Just one more. Go ahead. Double me up. Double me up. I want one in a shot before you close. You're not closed. Hey, how much? Let me buy the bottle. Can I buy the bottle? It's, you know, it's a $20 bottle of Jack. I'll give you $50 for the bottle of Jack. We don't have a packaged good license, Rich. Come on, I'll buy it for $100. All of that stuff is that phenomenon of craving, just driven, you know. But the worst part of that is that if that was the problem, not drinking would solve it. But it doesn't. We know that, or we wouldn't be here. Even knowing that that thing happens inside of me, my mind always brings me back. And that's different for me because I have other allergies. He called it an allergy. He said, what else are you allergic to? I'm allergic to pollen, ragweed, pretty much that everything spring offers, dogs, cats. I've gotten allergy shots since I've been a kid. And I take, now I don't get the shots, I take a Zyrtec or whatever they are for allergies when they get really bad and my eyes water. I'm also allergic, he said, anything else? I said, yeah, well, strawberries. And that's, if I eat a strawberry, I will get red blotches on my face. You'll have to hit me with an EpiPen and my throat will close and I'll die. I learned that at like 3 or 4 years old. I'm happy to report to you, I stand here at 42 years old. I've never had another strawberry. I don't go to Strawberries Anonymous. I don't have a strawberry sponsor. I don't have any crazy thoughts like maybe I can have strawberries if I eat them on the weekends. You know, what if I slice them and put them on ice cream? Can I have them while I'm on vacation? I'm not sitting at lunch today counting how many strawberries you're eating. None of that, you know? And that tells you that my relationship with strawberries is just not the same as alcohol. How come? It's just how we started this whole thing. I'm an alcoholic because of what alcohol does for me. I drink primarily for the effect produced by alcohol. I don't get anything from those strawberries. They just kill me. Alcohol kills me and gives me some stuff at first. Right? He explained that if I'm powerless, would you agree that that means you've got less power? I'm like, oh yeah, yeah. makes sense. Less power than to do what? Is there any decision that you can think of that you've made time and time and time and time again? Can you just think of one? Well, yes, Jim, that I'm never, ever, ever
going to drink again.
Well, how are you doing managing that decision?
Not very good, Jim.
Oh, so you're telling me that you have less power than is required to manage your most sincere desire to never drink again, and that's what you're looking at. And boy, I wish somebody told me that about that's what that first step meant. See, this is a textbook. It says it on the front cover, but we don't really read that kind of stuff if you're an alcoholic of my variety. And a textbook's a different kind of book. If you look up what a textbook is, because he made me, a textbook is a tool used for teaching and learning. That's the definition. A textbook, a tool used for teaching and learning. He said, there's going to be a teacher, there's going to be a learner. Guess which one you are, hotshot? Right? Also, textbooks, what's different about a textbook, they're in a specific order for a specific reason. I knew about textbooks. Nobody ever handed me an algebra book and said, go home and learn it by yourself. You can't. They're not meant to be used like that, like what Dave talked about. It doesn't matter how many degrees you have. A textbook requires a teacher and to go in a specific order. And it tells us that on the very front cover, the basic text for alcohol, but yet I'm on a mission to do it myself somehow. Right? It's good to have a sponsor. You know? And we start going through the rest of this and I do that inventory with him and put that stuff down, and we're getting up to amends. And when we get up to amends, Jim was getting older, and he handed me to my current sponsor, this guy Roger McMahon. He likes me to use his full name because he's pushing 80. He's got a pacemaker, congestive heart failure. He usually ends up at Peninsula Regional Medical Center when his heart acts up, and he loves people visiting him, and it's real hard to find Roger M. You know. By the way, Dr. Bob Smith said it is just as much a breach of anonymity to be anonymous from each other as it is to break our anonymity out in the world. We are not anonymous from one another. So if you're ever at the beach, you know, and you look up Roger McMahon, he's in the phone book. He tells me to say it because he'd love to hear from another drunk. He'll take you to a meeting. It'll be the bright spot of his day. And if he's in the hospital, you'll have to do what I do. If you call, you'll sit next to his bed, and he lays back and closes his eyes and says, just read me We Agnostics over and over and over. And I get to do that. It just brings him this. I don't know why he loves it, but I just do what he says. And so Roger says this 9-step kit. He says, AA, all AA is up till step 9. This is the only bad word you'll hear me say from a podium because I try to be respectful of this most wonderful thing that you gave me. I don't know another way. This is as close as I get to God is with you. And I like to treat it that way. And that's just me. But what he said, Alcoholics Anonymous up to step 9 is largely theoretical. All you are up until step 9, Rich, is a self-informed asshole. And he was right. Because nobody out there in the world, they could care less that I've made some peace with the God of my understanding in steps 1, 2, and 3. They could care less that I've written all this inventory and shared it with my sponsor. They don't care. They could care less that in step 6 and 7 I could tell you all about my defects and shortcomings, maybe throw in an asset if I'm having a down day, you know. They don't care that I got a list of what I'm going to make right. But step 9, he said, kid, this is where you maybe, just maybe, get to rub the record clean. Maybe you get to die with both sides of the slate clean. Maybe, just maybe, how free do you want to be? And this is up to you, buddy. We got all kinds of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got everything in here from ground beef to filet mignon. What do you want? What do you want? And I started dating my mom. And my first job, I was sweeping the floor in a picture frame shop owned by a longtime sober AA guy. My hands were shaking so bad I just had to keep the sawdust off the floor. And that was all I could do all day long. I made $6.25 an hour. And we listened to those speaker CDs all day long. One after another, and he'd take me to a meeting at night. And off that little bit of money, man, I had enough for a dollar in your basket every night and to take my mom to dinner once a week. I don't know if anybody's noticed that a little becomes a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I stop drinking and that other stuff, the little bit I have. And the book talks about that when I focus on the spiritual, the material takes care of itself. But when my focus shifts to the material, it never works out. I'd had it backwards my whole life, much like everything else. And when I just followed you all around, and at this point I'm going to meetings I didn't used to go to, right? I'm starting to like the meetings I used to not like. Anybody had that? Right? I'm starting to be drawn strangely to those weird guys with that look in their eye and the smile that I used to try to stay the heck away from. I'm starting to, something inside me is becoming inwardly reorganized, as our book says. You know, and I'm dating my mom and dating my mom and dating my mom. And good God, at 30, that is not so cool. But what happened one night is nothing short of spectacular. We were at Carrabba's, and I don't know how long it was and how many dates, but she was eating spaghetti and meatballs, and I'll always remember it because she was twisting it around, and her eyes came up from the plate of food, and she was talking to me eyeball to eyeball, mother to son.
the way that the things are supposed to be. It's the natural order of the universe. I've been fighting all along. Sons and mothers are supposed to be able to talk eye to eye. And I get to go to her house now, and I get to take out trash because she's getting up in her 70s and it gets too heavy. I get to change light bulbs in the kitchen because she can't stand on a chair. She's got one light bulb in the kitchen that lights up a little dinette in her kitchen area. She used to call me and say, I can't see to cook or eat. Can you please come change the light bulb? And it would take me 2 to 3 weeks to get in good enough shape to show up to do that. And I'd leave my little old mother in the dark. That's what kind of son I was. And thank God, because of AA, I get to be there. I will tell you that 3 years ago, I got married for the first time at 38 years old to this beautiful little 27-year-old girl. And I was just telling her the other night that God loves me a lot more than her, because I'm good at coming up with clever romantic things like that when we lay on the pillow. And she said, what in the world are you talking about? And I said, well, just think about it for a second, honey. He gave me you, and he only gave you me. And then she liked me again. But that is how I feel about it. And we have this spectacular house on the water, looking out at the Chesapeake Bay with the island of Ocean City and the ocean in back, and we watch the sun come up, and we own the joint, and it turns out we own the joint because there's... If you're new, I'll tell you this is unbelievable to me. When you pay your bills, you get good credit. That's it. That's my financial lesson. That's what AA taught me. I was like baffled by that my whole life, why I had a sub-zero credit score. And then you were like, you know, you got to open the bills and pay them. And I started doing that, and over like a decade, you know, it goes way up, and you get to buy a house. It's pretty neat. And it's not what AA is about, but it is the byproducts of right living. It's the byproducts of right living. And while the house is spectacular, I get to walk out front to get on a surfboard to, you know, paddle out and do all kinds of great stuff. And I could go on and on about the wife. And we just had our first, my daughter's Isabella. She's 9 months old. Isabella is a Spanish name. It means God's precious gift. All of this stuff, if you ask my mother about the best part of this house, she ain't going to tell you my son can go surfing. She ain't going to say it's right on the water. She ain't going to tell you about the sun. She's going to say my son and my daughter-in-law built a house 1.7 miles away so they could be close to me in my old age, and if I need anything, he's there. That's what my mom thinks is the most spectacular thing about that house. And I don't want to keep going on and off time about my relationship with my mother. I will tell you, she's at my house almost every day. We actually have a schedule between the two, my mom and her mom, of who gets to babysit what day so they don't fight each other is how often they're at our house. My mother couldn't even look at me. And I think the last thing I want to say about the mother-son deal, if there's anybody sitting in this room that still thinks you're some kind of badass, tough guy and you just want to be a man, all I wanted my whole life was to be a man and to come off like a man. And it's real hard to be a man if you first don't learn how to be a son. And that's my experience with that relationship. Next was my sister. She hadn't spoken to me in 6.5 years, and I got sober. I had all my clothes in a bag, you know, like we do, that plastic bag. And I had a set of Baltimore Ravens season tickets. I don't know why I had them. But we're all like that when we get to AA. We've got nothing we should and something we shouldn't have. There's somebody in this room that no doubt somebody picked up from a homeless shelter. You don't have a house. You don't have a bank account, but you got an iPhone 6. You know, and I have no idea why you got an iPhone 6. But, you know, I pick up newcomers and I'm like, why do you have that? You know, and, you know, I pick them up at the homeless shelter and they have like some Apple computer thing that, like, I don't have. I'm like, what? But that's just how we are. None of our world doesn't make sense, you know, and but we can't tell that. It makes perfect sense to us. You know, oh, I'm a big Ravens fan. I'm a season ticket holder in the homeless shelter. You know? And, he says, send him to your sister. She lives in Baltimore. You live at the beach. You don't even like going to the games anymore. You liked getting drunk and having a big tailgate. You didn't even know who won by the time the game was over. And that was the truth of it. And in case you can't tell, it's hard for me to sit still for 3 hours. I don't even like going to the games. I like surfing. I like being at your events. I like being in the game, baby. Like, you guys have given me a life back through these steps and this God that you've introduced me to that put me back in the stream of life. I'm letting go of the rock, baby, and I'm going with the current because it's fun. I love that story, and I'm never going to forget it. I'm better for having been with you today, and that is always the case. I don't want to confuse that with the difference between relief and recovery. Relief is what I get when they say, pick your butt up and take it to a meeting. I've never been to a meeting where usually I feel better leaving the meeting for about an hour. That's relief. That's meeting-based recovery. Morning meeting. Feel better for an hour. Better get to the noon meeting. Work's been tough this morning. Went to the noon meeting. Feel better for about an hour. Better get to the night meeting. You know, that is meeting-based deal right there. That gives me relief from having gone to a meeting. Very different than recovery. Recovery is that permanent condition where the problem, as our book says, and I'm just quoting you, the problem has been removed. I can tell you that for over a decade, the problem has been removed. I think about drinking about as often as I think about Lithuania, you know, and like every blue moon, about once every 3 years, there'll be a story on the 10 o'clock news, right, with some little girl carrying a cat with a bridge blowing up in back of her and like terror strikes in Lithuania. And I'm like, oh my God, honey, isn't that terrible? And I think about Lithuania for like a split second, and then the next day it's gone. And about another 5 years will pass, and maybe something will be on the news about Lithuania, and it'll pop back in my head. But that is how frequently I think about alcohol, is as often as Lithuania. And that is amazing for a person that did nothing but drink or think about drinking. And that is the result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Getting to live happy, joyous, and free. Sending those tickets. He says, send them to your little sister. What is that going to do? She doesn't even talk to me. That is stupid. He said, shut up and send them. Nothing happened after the first game, but the second game, that phone rang. And on the other end of that phone was a little girl's voice that said, Richie, 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 did you see that? They just caught the ball. They caught it in the end zone. The Ravens are tied. I don't know who they were playing. I could have cared less that they were tied, but I was talking to my little sister, man, for the first time in 6.5 years. And it was a big deal. And I kept sending those tickets, and we kept talking, and this little relationship developed around football that led to becoming the best of friends and led to me going and helping her on the weekends fix up her house in Baltimore 3 hours each way after working all week. I never wanted to do it. When I got sober, I owed the IRS $47,000. He drove me to Baltimore. I talked to the IRS. He said, you got to turn yourself in and square that up. I said, oh, no, they'll lock me up. He said, they're not going to lock up the goose that lays the golden egg. They want money. And he's right. And I now have taken more guys than I could care to tell you to the IRS to sit down with the same lady that I sit down with if we can get an appointment with her, because she's like my angel. And we set up a $20 a week plan where I've paid them back $20. And I have no idea how you pay back $47,000, $20 a week. Doesn't make sense. I had a plan. You all probably had the same plan. I'm going to pay them back the whole $47,000 when I have it. Right? The problem is it never happens. And you know when the relief came? You know when the relief came? Not with the last check, which has been paid. Came with the first check. As soon as I put that first $20 in the mail, they stopped calling. The letters stopped coming. I was in the solution, and I started sleeping better at night. See, you all taught me that a clear conscience makes for a soft pillow. How free do you want to be, kid? You kept telling me that. Thank God I didn't take some stupid sleeping pills. Thank God I didn't do some of the other suggestions I've heard. Thank God you guys said, what do you take? How do you sleep around here? You said, we take the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. A clear conscience makes for a soft pillow. After some years, the little boy named Justin that my sister had been dating called. He said, Rich, I know your father's no longer with you, but you're the number one man in your little sister's life. I'm calling to see if I could have her hand in marriage. And there's no drunk in the world less qualified to give away the hand of a beautiful little girl than the guy you're looking at. But darn if I didn't get to do it. And she called the next day asking if I'd walk her down that aisle and give her away. And I got to do that with my head up and my shoulders back, and it was one of the most spectacular days of my life. Thank God that relationship has been repaired. She's got 2 little boys, 2.5 and 1, Sadler and Brixton. And now my daughter Isabella gets to grow up with 2 cousins, and they get to play together and be together. And you probably don't want to ask me for Easter pictures, because I'll keep you for 15 minutes. I am so happy hanging with my sister and my mom with all these kids stacked up on her. And all the people that could never be in the same house at the same time have been happily reunited under the same roof. And in case you're wondering why AA works, it tells us in the foreword to the second edition. You know, who reads forewords? Certainly not me. But it says in there, right in the very beginning, Alcoholics Anonymous is growing by leaps and bounds, primarily for 2 reasons. The large number of recoveries and the families reunited. And that's what we're all doing here. And last, I had this warrant. Well, I'll tell you about Ethan, because Ethan's now a sober. He wasn't at the time. My best friend in the world was a guy named Ethan. We grew up since this big together. He asked me to be the best man in his wedding. His father sent me a plane ticket that he paid for, had me fit it for a tuxedo. to be the best man in this wedding when I was living out in La Jolla. I was taking over the world one drug deal at a time. And I was so excited to be in his wedding that I started drinking the night before getting on the airplane. And you all know what happens because the book says the important engagement was not met. I get tight at exactly the wrong time. And when I do something like that, he went on a list that I keep deep in my guts. When I don't show up at something like that, you know, you go on that secret list that we keep in our gut of the people that I can't answer their phone call. That's what caller ID is for. If you need to look at caller ID before you answer the phone, you're living in what's called bondage of self. Talk to your sponsor about that. I don't have time. But there was a whole lot of people that I couldn't answer the phone for a whole lot of different reasons. And when Ethan would call, I knew why he was calling, to tell me what a no-good bum I was. Thanks a lot for not showing up at my wedding. You're a drunken bum. I heard his wife was spectacular. Then I heard they had a kid. Then I heard they had another. I mean, the longer time went on, the sicker and sicker and sicker. And the tighter that knot gets in my stomach. And he was next, and I called and said, Eighth, this is Rich. I'm in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't ever want to drink again, man, and I really screwed up at your wedding, and I owe your dad money, and I know you probably hate me, man, but I need 5 minutes of your time to try to straighten this thing out so that I don't ever have to take another drink. This is a life or death deal, man. Can I please have 5 minutes? And he said, yeah, you could be here Saturday morning at 7 a.m. if you can make it. And that was 9 years later, so he remembered. I think he had a resentment. And I showed up, and his parents' car was in the driveway, and I knocked on the door, and Ethan answered the door, and his wife was by the center island in the kitchen, and there was a little girl. She was holding hands, and the mother and father were in the back of the kitchen, and this little boy came running from the, I don't even know what room he was in, and he came running towards me like a freight train, and he grabbed a hold of my leg like a tree, and he looked up and said, you're my Uncle Rich? Daddy said one day I'd get to meet you. And he hadn't been telling those kids what a drunken bum I was. He'd been telling them they got an Uncle Rich, his best friend in the world. And you know what happened in that instant with that kid holding onto my legs? The scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. I had an inward knowing that I'm what separates me from you. My stupid ego, my inability to right the wrong and to say those words, I was wrong, that separates me from you. And the problem with that is when I'm separate from you, I'm separate from God. It's just that simple. And I went in the other room after doing my deal with Eighth, and I talked to his father. And his father said, after I made my amends to him, he said, you owe me $1,372. I didn't see that coming. But page 78 says that when the approach is made in this fashion, 9 out of 10 times, the unexpected happens. I started to pull out the money, and he said, no, if you're really in this AA thing, what you're going to do, you're not going to pay me. You're going to go to that home group you allegedly have, and you're going to, no more than $10 at a time, you're going to take some cookies or donuts or maybe some extra nice coffee every now and then, and you're going to save each receipt. None of them can be for more than $10. Put gas in a newcomer's car. Don't give them the money. Put the gas in their car. Save the receipt. When you have $1,372 in receipts, you bring them back to Baltimore and give them to me. On that day, your amends to me will be complete. By the way, I'm 28 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been praying for you too. Yeah, I didn't see that coming. Last, and I'll shut up, I had one outstanding amends in California. I was arrested for a DUI with some outside issues in my pocket, and they were worth 5 years in prison. The judge gave me probation. He said, I'm going to give you the 5 years. If you screw up this probation, you're going to do every day of the 5 years. Are we clear? I said to him what I say to every judge, you bet, Your Honor, I'll be your model guy. I mean, I believed that I could do it, right? Who wouldn't? I think I could complete the... I had no idea that alcohol wasn't going to let me complete that probation. I can't go to 10 AA meetings. Whoa, you know? What an order. I can't go through with it. And you know, do this and that and the other thing. No way. I thought I could. Alcohol had other plans for me. To just keep kicking the snot out of me. That was alcohol's plan. He said, now's a good time to do the 5 years. Again, I didn't see it that way. I thought that this relationship with my mom, my sister, my home group, the men's big book study that was in my living room, all of this stuff was going on, and I'm explaining that to him. And he said, no, this is a good time. I had this girlfriend, and we were living together. And he said, let me help you see this. First of all your mother's ever wanted you to do is do the right thing. Why don't you talk to your mother and see what she would have you do? And I talked to my mother, and he was right. She just wanted me to make right and to do the right thing, to be a stand-up guy, to be the man she raised. He said my girlfriend was better off without me, that she was 18 years sober. She had a God in her life, a sponsor of her own, and she was probably way better before I came into her life. She'd be just fine. He said that this career that I had, sweeping the floor. He said that that's not a career. Just about anybody could sweep the floor, that they'd be fine. And this house that we had, he said, it's not a house. It's a trailer. You don't own it. You rent it. This is a good time to go to prison for 5 years. Sponsors, see, they see things different. I didn't see any of that. And off I went, and I went, and I stood a bunch of guys from the home group. My sponsor took me to the airport, and I was scared to death, and I went in front of the judge. I was in the bathroom 3 times that morning. I had sweat circles under my arms. I was vomiting. I mean, I was scared. Any of this business, faith and fear can't be in the same house at the same time. I don't know about that. I was scared to death, and I had faith that it was going to work out how it was supposed to. And that's what happened to me, and I stood in front of the judge, and he said, what do you have to say for yourself? And I said, Your Honor, you know I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a couple years sober now. I'm here to serve that 5 years so that I don't ever have to drink. Let's get it on. And what I didn't know was that 47 of you wrote the judge letters telling him what my life looked like and what I was doing in AA and the guys I was sponsoring. He couldn't even believe I flew 3,000 miles on my own nickel to go do that 5 years. And he said something I'd never heard a judge say. He said, this case is dismissed. And 36 times I've gone to jail. That was the first time I didn't go to jail. And I stepped outside and I called my sponsor. I said, Roger, I'm coming home. Tell the guys I'm coming home. I don't have to do the 5 years. And he said, wait a second, hotshot. What about that Jesuit college that kicked you out? Aren't you out there? You can't get a plane ticket home until tomorrow. Why don't you swing by that college and square that up? And I'm thinking, wait a second. Can we celebrate for a minute? But I went over to the school, and wouldn't you know it, all those years later, the same dean that kicked me out was there, and I made my amends, and I told her I knew what I did. I shamed that university, and I shamed the Jesuits. I didn't at the time know what they were, but I do as a sober member of AA. Jesuits stand for building men and women of integrity. They stand for education. They stand for doing the right thing. I didn't stand for any of that. And I said, I brought a ton of shame to this place, and I don't know how to make it right, but I'll do whatever you tell me. That's how I'm told to end all my amends. I don't know how to make this right. I don't presume to know. It's like spiritually placing yourself at the feet. It's a form of spiritual surrender. I don't know how to make this right, but I'll do whatever you tell me. And what she said was, come with me. And she took me to the building next door and put a huge stack of papers in front of me and said, fill this out. This is an application to our law school. If you want to make this right, what you're going to do is you're going to go to school here. You're going to graduate and you're going to go on to make us proud. We like to graduate students. We don't like to kick them out. What makes us look good is having a high graduation rate. You're going to go out front and I call Roger and I said, this lady's lost her mind. She wants me to go to law school. I've been arrested 36 times. I'm a federal felon. Even if I get through law school and I'm dumb, I don't know how I'm going to go to law school. And then they're not going to let me take the bar. And even if I pass the bar, the ethics committee is never going to let me practice law. He said, shut up. Did you just tell her you do what she said? And I said, yes, I did. He said, then shut up and fill out the papers. I went inside. I filled out the papers. 3 years later, I graduated second from the top of my class in the law school. Not because I'm smart. I did it the AA way. I went 15 minutes early to every class, and I shook every teacher's hand until they knew my name personally. I stayed after class 15 minutes. Whether I had a question or not, I'd make one up. It develops a personal relationship with the teacher, just like we do with the newcomer. That principle you taught me in AA served me very well. And I graduated from that school, passed the bar, got waved into D.C. and Maryland and to California. I mean, it was spectacular what was happening. And I hadn't even been out, and I did have to go through the ethics committee, and I don't have time to talk about it. But I can tell you that it hadn't been 3 months and the phone rang. On the other end of the phone, and thank God I could answer it, because it was a number I'd never seen. And on the other end of the phone was a guy that said he was the state's attorney for the state of Maryland, and he had the governor on the other line. He said he'd been given a large federal grant to hire an assistant state's attorney, that he wanted somebody to head up a gang and narcotics prosecution unit. He was given my phone number, that I might know something about the importation of narcotics into our country. And my response was about the same as yours. But you know what I remembered? I remembered what those old guys with that smile on their face and that book in their hand promised me. And it's in the black print. Old Jim said, hey, kid, one day your sordid past will become your greatest asset. And I have served, I repeat, served the state of Maryland in that capacity for almost 7 years now. It was hard at first. The judge would say tricky things in the morning, like, will the defendant please rise? And he'd say, sit down, you're the prosecutor. It takes a while to get used to not being the defendant, but I've gotten used to it, and I'm really good at what I do. Because I was really bad at being a criminal. And it wasn't what God wanted me to do. And if it was somebody else standing there, they might see a guy doing an armed robbery of a liquor store at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know what I see? I see a guy that when the morning terror and madness were on would steal from his wife's slender purse, or their mother in my case. And I can tell you that I've come up with some very creative sentencing arrangements in the last 7 years. Just recently, my name, as well as three other lawyers from our state, got sent up to the governor, selected by a thing called the Judicial Nominating Committee, which happens when you practice law with the same set of principles that you learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. It turns out that your peers think you'd be a hell of a judge. And I don't know what's going to happen with that. My name's up there right now, nominated for a judge. I may or may not be one. It would make me the second youngest judge in the state of Maryland. I'm 42. I don't know if where God wants me next. I know it's an exciting opportunity. I'm honored that my peers think enough of Alcoholics Anonymous to send my name up, because that's all I demonstrate. You folks have given me the only set of principles that I know in life, and they've served me so well in so many areas. In case you can't tell, I could go for hours with what you guys have given me. I'll shut up with two things. Every day I say two amazing things. In the morning, I say, "Good morning, Your Honor. Rich Bruckner for the state of Maryland." And every night I get to say the much cooler thing. I get to come somewhere like this and say that my name is Rich Bruckner. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for my life.